the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science!
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to Journey Number 52 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring The Last Days of the Kelly Gang by David D. Levine. I am your guide on this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in Turner, Oregon. I am very excited to bring you today's story. Now, that's generally true. I enjoy all the stories I bring to you, but this one has a little bit more of a personal connection. Let me tell you how I was first introduced to this story. As many of you know, I moved back to Oregon last year. And in January, I learned that there was a CEFWA reading to take place in Portland, Oregon. And if you don't know, CEFWA, S-F-W-A, is for the Science Fiction Writers of America. So they had a reading in Portland in January. And the featured authors were going to be John A. Pitts, Ken Scholes, and some other guy. And I was mainly going to hear Ken because I've been a fan of his stories and books. And, Ken's reading was fantastic. And John A. Pitts was good as well. But the other guy who was supposed to read couldn't make it. And so it was announced that David D. Levine would be reading. So I thought, wow, talk about your grand slam here. The evening was also hosted by Mary Robinette Cole. So it was a good evening for speculative fiction, that's for sure. So anyway, David was the last reader of the night, and he begins reading this story, The Last Days of the Kelly Gang. And he gets going, and the audience, you know, we're all getting into the story, totally wanting to know what's going to happen next. And David gets to a critical part in the story, and then stops, and says, if you want to hear the rest, you're going to have to go out and buy the John Joseph Adams Armored Anthology. It's out in stores, and such and such a date. Now, who says that writers aren't good salesmen? Well, I couldn't wait, so I approached David and asked him, how would you like to have this story podcasted? I had never met David before, but I knew that he was open to podcasting because I had heard his stories podcasted on Escape Pod and Drabblecast. That was my introduction to David's stories, was through those podcasts. So I guess you can guess the rest, since this story is coming your way, that he was up for it. And I'm glad that he was. In case you're not familiar with David's work, you should know that David D. Levine is a lifetime science fiction reader whose midlife crisis was to take a sabbatical from his high-tech job to attend Clarion West in 2000. And it seems to have worked. He made his first professional sale in 2001. He won the Writers of the Future contest in 2002. He was nominated for the John W. Campbell Award in 2003 and was nominated for the Hugo Award and the Campbell again in 2004. And he won the Hugo in 2006 for his short story, Tick, 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 which I first heard on Escape Pod. And a collection of his short stories, titled Space Magic, from Wheatland Press, won the Endeavor Award in 2009. And I also have that collection of short stories, and it's definitely worth reading. I might be talking to David about podcasting another story from that. David lives in Portland, Oregon, with his wife, Kate Yule, with whom he edits the fanzine Bento. And their website is at www.bentopress.com. And I'll definitely have links in the show notes for these things. This story also marks a first for the podcast. The man responsible for this production is Tim Heffernan. Tim lives in Australia and is the producer of The Drama Pod, which features quality audio dramas and fun fiction. It's worth checking out. Tim said that it all started when he heard the Kenny Everett radio show and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy on the radio. While only a child at the time, his jaw dropped by listening to the fusion of an audio story coupled with his own imagination. And then several years ago, he was listening to audiobooks, and inspiration struck. Now is the time to bring back audio dramas. Now he has finally found the right outlet for his creative mind. So I recommend that you head on over to The Drama Pod, which is just thedramapod.com, and check out Tim and his awesome team of actors, and be prepared to be entertained. And this story will be simultaneously podcasted on The Drama Pod. And I'm very grateful for Tim and all of his hard work on this story and for making it possible to bring it to you today. I should also let you know that this story is being used with the generous permission of John Joseph Adams and Bain Books from the anthology Armored. So please, come with me and let's journey into the heart of Australia. Let's journey outside the law and into remorse.
The Last Days of the Kelly Gang by David D. Levine.
Dyke awoke to the sound of heavy fists on his little shack's door. Sighing, he dragged his creaking body from under the covers, letting in June's winter cold as his foot saw his slipper under the bed.
I'm coming,"
he called as the pounding came again. No one ever visited Old Dyke's shack, especially not in the middle of the night with a winter storm threatening. Annoyed, he kindled a tallow candle and shuffled his way across boards worn smooth by 20 years of his footsteps.
"Yes, yes, what is..."
Ike's voice seized in his throat at the apparition revealed in the open door, a tall man in a long duster coat, his face dominated by a huge, raggy beard and capped by a battered leather hat, stood limned by a flash of lightning. A moment later came the clap of thunder, followed by a deep, uncultured voice.
"I'm looking for a man called Crazy Old Ike."
The man's accent combined broad Australian vowels with the lilt and crisp consonants of the Irish.
"I'm Gold Ike,"
he acknowledged, deliberately broadening his vowels to conceal his own comfortable Hampshire origins. Poor Irish-Australian farmers and free selectors had little love for the English.
"And I'll loan to the old. What business have you with me?"
"I'm told you make things."
"I've been known to do so.
Can we come in?"
Ike glared at the man, who'd roused him from a sound sleep, but there was a storm coming. Perhaps at the age of 74, he was finally mellowing.
"Oh, very well. Wipe your feet."
He lit a lantern from the candle as they entered. The stranger wasn't alone. There were four of them, all told, lean, filthy young men with beards the size of shovel blades, all spurs and leather and the stink of horse sweat. The pistol handles that protruded from each duster pocket were decidedly worrisome, but Ike tried to reassure himself that out here in the bush, such implements were not necessarily a sign of bad intent.
"I'm Ned Kelly,"
said the first man, removing his hat.
"There's my brother Dan, and them's Joe Byrne and Steve Hart."
A small grin crept onto his weathered face.
"You may have heard of us."
Ike's old heart hammered, but he tried to keep his voice level.
"Indeed, I have."
"The Kelly Gang? were the most notorious bushrangers, horse thieves, and bank robbers in the entire colony of Victoria, and there was an 8,000-pound reward on their heads. But they were also beloved of the small farmers and free selectors. It was said that when they robbed banks, they burned all the mortgages they found, and afterwards distributed the cash to their relatives and sympathizers. With the help of the populace of the area, what was known as Kelly Country, they'd been at large for months.
I keep myself to myself up here,
I continued.
I try to stay clear of all affairs of government. You've nothing to fear from me.
That's good.
Ned's eyes flicked around the room, taking in the forge, the lathe and bending brake, the taps and dies, the drive belts that ran every which way. Apart from the bed and a small cook stove, the place was more workshop than home.
And you do appear to be a clever dick.
He pursed his lips and nodded slowly.
I think you might be the man for the job.
And what job might that be?
I want you to build us 4 suits of armor.
He handed Ike a scrap of paper with some crude sketches on it. The paper showed a cylindrical helmet, front and rear plastrons on the torso, curved flaps over the shoulders, and an apron-like panel protecting the groin area. It would be uncomfortable, encumbering, and, most offensive of all to his engineering sensibilities, ineffective. Ike snorted and tossed the paper back.
It won't work. It will,
Joe insisted.
It's just a matter of hammering them plowshares we stole into shape, cutting a few slots in them and fitting them with straps. Surely a bright spark like you can do that.
I didn't say it couldn't be built,
Ike countered.
I said it wouldn't work. The legs and arms are completely unprotected. One well-placed bullet could kill you right off. And if you added armor to those areas without changing the design, you'd lose too much mobility.
Joe started to protest, but Ned cut him off with a gesture.
You said without changing the design. You got a better?
Ignorant this ruffian might be, but he wasn't unobservant.
Not immediately, no. But given time, I suppose I could think one up.
Ned leaned forward, the eyes above the ratty beard fiercely intense.
Then you'd best think fast, Cobber, as we've a train to catch. On June 27th.
Less than 3 weeks away.
I'm terribly sorry if I gave the impression that I would work for you, sir. I was merely offering a critique of your design.
Ike straightened, bringing himself to his full 5'4".
It's been over 20 years since I did any work on contract for any other man.
Well then, you've a bit of a choice to make.
With a movement swift and sure as a piston stroke, Ned brought the revolver from his pocket and leveled it at Ike's head. Despite the bushranger's filth and stink, the gun was well oiled, and the hammer gave a precise click as it was drawn back.
You can build us the armor, or you can learn how to do without that big brain of yours.
Trembling, Ike stood his ground.
So, that's how it's to be.
He regretted having pointed out the flaws in the gang's design. This wasn't the first time his intellect had gotten him into trouble by outrunning his common sense, but still, armor was only defensive, after all, and the Kellys did have some support from the population. They couldn't be all bad. He'd build them what they wanted, and they'd go on their way. Besides, it would be an intriguing engineering challenge. He licked his lips.
Let's see that paper again.
Ike lay his weary head down on his drafting table just for a moment. The gang had settled in for the duration outside his shack, snug in their bedrolls around a pungent mallywood fire. But they slept in shifts, one or more of them keeping watch on him at all times, constantly demanding progress. He'd responded with a series of increasingly detailed sketches, then paper models. Knee and ankle joints, helmets, the insanely difficult shoulder joint. The gang members had scoffed at his playing with paper dolls, but Ned, who comprehended Ike's design drawings, despite being unable to read or write, had cuffed Joe across the ear.
Let the brain box work,
he'd said.
He knows how many beans make 5. Unlike you lot.
At the moment, Ike was working on a model of the leg assembly, stiff vellum curved and held into place with pins. He flexed the leg and sighed. The design was sound, fully covering the limb without unduly restricting movement, but if built from the heavy mold boards and other cast iron scraps the gang supporters were still delivering by wagon, it would be far too cumbersome to walk in. Yet no lighter material was available that could stop a single bullet, let alone the full police onslaught the gang said they expected to face. As he pondered the problem, a high, distant sound penetrated his consciousness. And his eyes automatically flicked to the clock. It was the 2:15 train, pulling into Glen Rowan half an hour late, as usual. He'd been pleased when the Northeast Line had been extended to Wangaratta back in 1873, making it far easier for him to obtain the instruments, materials, and few comforts he required from overseas, but its whistle also served as a daily reminder of the life he'd left behind in England. He'd had his successes there, to be sure. A few tunnels and trestles he'd designed had been entirely satisfactory to himself and his creditors, but his constant overweening ambition had not been satisfied, had always stretched for faster, bigger, better, more. In the end, it had brought him nothing but failure, disgrace, and heartbreak. But there had been a joy in engineering. The eternal duel between weight and power, the combat with recalcitrant materials, the exaltation of victory over an obstinate technical conundrum. And when the pieces did fit together, when the ship that he, by God, had designed actually floated, or the engine moved, the speed and power of it had made him laugh like a schoolboy. Power. Steam power. That was the ticket. It was the only way. Dual pistons would be required on each leg, a lift assist of some sort on the arms. The weight of the boiler would be a serious problem in the heat, but it could work. It could work, damn it. Grinning, he swept the drafting table clean and brought out a fresh sheet of vellum.
Try it now.
Ned moved his left leg forward. Through the rat's nest of rods, tubes, and cables that formed the prototype leg control assembly, Ike observed Ned's knee and ankle as they contacted the actuation levers. Steam hissed, and the framework lurched forward to match Ned's motion.
Still kind of touchy.
Ike selected an extra-long screwdriver from his tool chest and tweaked one of the verniers.
Again.
This time, the framework matched the motions of Ned's leg perfectly. Ike stood back, arms folded, watching and visualizing the armor plating that would cover it. The back of the knee would be tricky.
This is quite a piece of kit,
Ned admitted.
You're going to get a patent on it?
Patents?
Ike scoffed.
I've never taken out a one. They are supposed to encourage innovation in the useful arts, but in reality they smother innovation in the cradle.
Ned raised his hands against Ike's vehemence.
Sorry I mentioned it.
Later, after being unbuckled from the prototype, Ned wiped his brow with a bandana.
So how does a tough like you wind up in the Wombat Rangers anyway?
It was a very good question. Ike looked past him, staring through the wall, 10,000 miles of desert and ocean, and 20 years.
Failure.
Ned snorted.
I can't credit that. Look at this kit.
He gestured at the expensive imported tools and machinery that filled the shack.
I doubt you've ever spent a day hungry, never mind in jail.
Ike returned his focus to Ned, realizing that the gulf between them was nearly as large as the distance he'd just been contemplating.
That's true, but I failed at my chosen profession. Failed repeatedly and disastrously. All due to my own ambition and pride. The tunnel under the Thames, the atmospheric railway, the broad-gauge locomotive. They were all the best possible designs in theory, but every one of them met calamity in execution. And then, worst and last, that damnable steamship of mine.
The tidy, cluttered shack faded from Ike's sight, replaced by memories of great chains and hydraulic rams.
She should have been my triumph. The greatest ship ever built. But it took us over a year just to launch her. And then, on her very first foray into the channel...
He shook his head.
Explosion. Disaster. Death.
He looked Ned in the eyes.
She broke my heart, sir, and ruined my health. It was my own dear wife who suggested I pretend death and flee the country to escape the professional and financial catastrophe that would surely follow.
Ned regarded Ike contemplatively.
You said all them locomotives and steamships? And what all was the best possible designs? Did you build them yourself?
No, of course not. There were technicians, laborers, hundreds of workmen.
Ned nodded a decisive little jerk of his chin.
So then, you and I, we're not so far off each other. We've both been victimized by the errors of lesser men.
I wouldn't say that.
You were let down by your workmen?
Ned insisted.
While I, ever since I was 14 years of age, and due to no fault whatsoever of my own, have been chased and hounded by a parcel of big, ugly, fat-necked, wombat-headed, big-bellied, magpie-legged, narrow-hipped, splay-footed sons of Irish bailiffs or English landlords, which is better known as officers of justice or Victorian police, who some call honest gentlemen.
At this vehement outburst, Ed could no more than gape.
That's the difference between us,
Ned went on,
is that you can choose to run from your tormentors, whereas I choose to fight.
He leaned in close, his breath hot and sour and foul.
And with this armor you're building me, I'm going to win.
The work went slowly. Endless rounds of design and tests and fittings, peppered with interruptions and arguments. The biggest argument came on the 22nd of June, after Ike finally had to admit that there would not be sufficient time or materials to produce more than one set of armor. Hour after screaming hour, he feared that at any moment his head would be blown off his shoulders, but in the end even Steve, the youngest and most hot-headed of the gang, was forced to concede that building four full sets of the complex armor was not humanly possible. But even with his workload reduced by three-fourths, Ike's task was still hideously daunting. Day after struggling day, night after sleepless night, he dragged and pounded and forged and bent an endless pile of stolen iron moldboards until his eyes were red and his white mutton chop whiskers had gone entirely black with soot. The gang helped out with the lifting and hauling, but all of the design and fine work was Ike's. Three complete boilers were built, found wanting, and discarded. Every time Ike thought he'd steered a safe course between the Scylla and Charybdis of power and weight, he realized that the boiler would either weigh so much that the armor would never budge, or would burst asunder under pressure, as that damnable steamship had done. In the end, he found a solution, involving reinforcing bands of chromium steel that seemed satisfactory, though distressingly close to the material's tolerances. Finally, just before dawn, on June the 26th, the thing was done. It had long before grown too large to be accommodated inside Ike's shack, and he had moved his workspace to the yard behind it. Ike had been working by the light of a windproof lantern, but as he tightened the last bolt and stepped back to inspect his work, he found that it was no longer necessary and snuffed it out. The rising sun traced the edges of the armor's riveted plates, outlining its black man-like shape with a tracery of glowing orange. It stood over 8 feet high. Each leg was big around as a tree trunk, a proper English tree, not the stunted wrist-thick mallees of the wombat ranges, and the torso bulked as large as a butt wine cask. Within that giant shell lay the pistons and rods that drove the legs and arms, great quantities of wool padding to insulate the operator from the heat and motion of the mechanisms, and of course the operator himself. Operator was the term Ike preferred, not wearer, as Ned insisted, though Ike had carefully positioned the control levers so that the natural motions of the operator's legs would cause the suit to walk, the suit's occupant would also be required to constantly direct, adjust, and monitor its workings. The helmet was the only thing about it that resembled Ned's original sketch, a bucket shape with a horizontal eye slit. Twin smokestacks rose above the shoulders. It weighed over 3,000 pounds. It was a thing of beauty. Breast swelling with pride, Ike lay his abraded and blackened hand on the armor's side. It was as high as he could reach. Cleared his throat and spoke.
I dub thee, Goliath.
A sharp sound from behind Ike made him whirl in surprise. Ned stood there, had apparently been there for some time, and was applauding, slow, measured claps.
Well done, mate,
he said, and stepped forward to slap Ike on the back.
Well done. But it could be even better.
From his duster pocket he drew one of his revolvers and fitted it into the armor's right hand. Sunlight gleamed greasily on the pistol's barrel.
Now we're all set for tomorrow's festivities.
Ike felt sick at heart.
Feed valve for the left legs here,
Ike reminded, pointing.
Right leg here. Arms here and here. Relief valves here. Don't adjust it unless I tell you to.
The sweat stink of Ned's body fought in Ike's nostrils with the tang of hot iron and the greasy kerosene smell of the naphtha-powered boiler as he leaned in to tighten the strap across Ned's chest. Even with the chest plate open, the heat was nearly intolerable.
Do you understand?
Feed, legs, arms, relief.
Ned touched each valve in turn.
Right. All sorted. Close me up.
Ike closed and dogged the chest plate shut and stepped back. He could see only darkness through the slit in the helmet.
Can you see?
In reply, Ned raised the armor's arm, the mechanisms hissing and groaning as steam shrieked from the shoulder and elbow joints, aimed the pistol over Ike's head, and fired. A moment later came a tearing crack and a shiver of leaves as a limb fell from a nearby mallee tree. A flock of pink galahs burst into the air, chirping their distress.
Well enough,
Ned said, his voice echoing in metallic.
Now let's get to work.
It was the morning of Sunday, the 27th of June. On the previous day, they'd hauled the disassembled armor in two wagons down the hill to the outskirts of the little town of Glen Rowan and made camp there. All was in readiness for whatever the gang had been planning for so many months. Smoking and spewing steam from every joint, Goliath jolted down the hill toward town, shaking the ground with every step. The other three gang members followed, dragging Ike along, in case anything should happen to go wrong. He didn't know if he was intended as engineer or hostage. Perhaps both. Glen Rowan was little more than a loose assemblage of buildings and tents surrounding a railway station with a population of perhaps 70. Dan, Joe, and Steve fanned out through the town, rousting the populace from their homes and businesses, while Ned, inside Goliath, stomped toward the tiny train station, which also served as post and telegraph office.
"Don't you dare get out of my sight,"
Ned growled, and Ike followed him. One blow of Goliath's iron fist shattered the telegraph office door into flinders.
"You inside?"
Ned roared, pointing his revolver into the office.
"Telegraph man, come out and bring your pad and pencil."
The postmaster, a slim, sandy-haired gentleman, soon emerged, holding the requested items high in his trembling hands.
"Take this down and send it to all the newspapers,"
Ned said, his voice booming metallically.
"Let it be known to all and sundry that I, Ned Kelly, along with my compatriots, have bailed up and taken hostage the entire populace of Glen Rowan. The Felons Apprehension Act of 1878 having expired on June 26, we are no longer outlaws, and therefore the common people may aid and abet us without fear of government reprisal."
Ike blinked up at Ned, the fierce sun haloing his cylindrical helmet. So that was why he had been so insistent that the armor be completed by this day.
"We invite all the people seeking innocence, justice, and liberty to join us here. Today, June the 27th, of the year of our Lord, 1880, marks the birth of the Republic of Northeastern Victoria."
After Ned's proclamation had been copied down, repeated back, and transmitted to his satisfaction, he clumped around to the side of the station, straightened the armor to its full height, reached up one mighty arm, and wrenched the telegraph wires down to the wall. But that act of destruction wasn't enough. Ned clanked out onto the railroad track, walking several hundred yards toward Melbourne. Then Goliath bent down, grasped one of the rails in its vice-like hands, and groaning with steam shrieking, straightened up. The rail cried out as it was torn from its bed, bending into a useless twist of metal. Its sibling rail protested its demise equally loudly and with equally little effect. Ike had spent most of his engineering career building railroads. The inevitable consequences of this vandalism was as clear in his mind as if he'd already witnessed it with his own eyes. The next train to arrive would come barreling around the curve at full speed, slam into the damaged section, and tumble off the tracks in a shower of sparks and flying metal. Everyone on the train would surely be killed. Ned walked back to the town and brought Goliath to a halt near the shattered telegraph office. Then the chest plate clanged open.
"No, we wait,"
Ned said as he emerged, running with sweat.
"They'll send a train full of constables to hunt us down like dogs, but they'll find a bit of a surprise when they arrive."
He gestured to the torn-up track, his face set in a hideous, leering grin.
"It'll be a spectacular,"
Ike gulped. This was monstrous. What had seemed at first little more than an interesting engineering problem had turned into insurrection, treason, and slaughter, and now he was right in the middle of it. He had to find some way to warn the officers that they were speeding into an ambush. But how? The gang herded the population into the Glen Rowan Inn, a wood-framed pub and hostelry that was the settlement's largest structure. Many of the townspeople were Kelly's supporters, and the occupation had more of the mood of a celebration than a siege, with dancing, card-playing, and drinking. Ned left the armor standing where it was, hidden behind the station from the view of any inbound train, with a low flame under the boiler to keep it ready for action. One member of the gang stood watch over it at all times, which incidentally prevented Ike from approaching the station in search of some means to signal the train. Ike was pacing behind the bar when Steve came in from guard duty.
"Hey, Brain Box,"
he said.
"It stopped making that noise, and it's gone all cold. Something wrong?"
"I'll have a look,"
Ike said.
"I'll need my tool chest."
Staggering with the weight of the heavy chest, Ike allowed Steve to chivvy him along to the armor, which stood beside the station like a triumphal statue to a battle that had not yet occurred. No hint of smoke rose from the stacks. Plainly, the naphtha flame had simply run out of fuel.
"Get to it, Brain Box,"
Steve said, gesturing sharply with his pistol. He fidgeted nervously, bouncing on his toes. Then Ike spotted the telegraph cable's broken end, lying in the dirt a few paces away, and a plan began to formulate itself in his mind.
Looks like a framulated wasagamut,
he said.
Might be a bit.
Ike puttered industriously and pointlessly for long minutes, keeping an eye on Steve and an ear out for the oncoming train. Steve grew increasingly agitated, shifting from foot to foot, and Ike feared the bushranger's patience was wearing thin. But then a miracle occurred.
Gotta visit the dunny,
Steve said, backing away around the corner of the station.
Don't you dare break nothing.
As soon as he heard the sound of pattering liquid, Ike set his plan into motion. Grabbing a small electrical battery from his tool chest, he scuttled to the point where the broken telegraph cable's catenary curve lay tangent to the ground. Twisting one of the exposed wires onto one battery terminal, he touched the other wire to the other terminal in a rapid series of Morse code pulses. Tracks torn up in Glen Rowan. Stop. Ned Kelly has armor. Stop. Use all caution. Stop. Just as he finished the message, Ike realized the sound of Steve's urine had already stopped. Slipping the battery into his coat pocket, he hurried back to Goliath's side, arriving just as Steve returned.
Found the problem,
he gasped. Steve looked up from buttoning his trousers.
What's wrong? You're all flushed.
Just the excitement of a difficult engineering problem.
He struggled to calm himself as he filled the armor's fuel reservoir and lit the pilot light. Soon the boiler was rumbling to itself as it had before, and Steve herded him back inside. As he lugged the heavy tool chest along, Ike wondered whether he should have tried to sabotage the armor somehow, as well as warning the police about the torn-up track. But as soon as they arrived at the inn, Ned got up and left to check on the armor, giving Ike a penetrating look as he passed. He had worked so closely with Ike on Goliath's development that he would know immediately if anything were wrong. And if Ned even suspected Ike of shady dealings, or if the armor suddenly malfunctioned, one word to his gang would put a bullet through Ike's head. No, sabotage was out. All Ike could do now was hope that someone in authority had received his message and would believe it. Hours passed. The sun set. The card playing and dancing grew desultory and then ground to a halt. Many people bedded down in corners, laid low by drink or by simple exhaustion. Only a few remained seated at the table, including Ike and the four members of the gang, sitting quietly and drinking cold Billy tea. At 2 o'clock in the morning, Ned finally gave in.
All right, everyone,
he called out.
You can all go home. No excitement tonight, but I want all of you to remember one thing.
But no one would ever know what Ned wanted. He was interrupted by the distant cry of a train whistle. The gang immediately roused themselves, smiling and slapping each other's shoulders, joking about how they would pick off any constables who survived the crash.
Like stomping ants as they scurry from a crushed anthill.
Ned then ran to the armor and strapped himself in. Even as he closed the chest plate, Ike heard the boiler coming up to full pressure. The inn's lights were extinguished. Ike and the other hostages shushed and told to keep still or be shot. The three gang members ducked down behind windowsills, anticipating a fine view of the upcoming train wreck. They waited. The tension mounted as the wait went on, seemingly interminable. Ike felt that he had never in his life waited so long between the sound of the whistle and the arrival of a train. And then came the chuffing of the engine, and Ike realized that his telegraph had been received. The train was not rushing toward disaster. Instead, it was slowing. Slowly, slowly, the train pulled up to the damaged section of track and stopped. The three gang members, muttering amongst themselves, slipped out of the inn and arranged themselves in the deep shadows of the veranda. Ike and some of the townspeople took their vacated positions at the windowsill so as to see the proceedings. By the light of a gibbous moon, Ike saw men boiling from the train, carrying pistols and rifles, and taking up positions behind barrels and buildings.
Ned Kelly, this is Superintendent Hare. We have you outnumbered and outgunned. Surrender peaceably, and you will be given a fair... Dear God in heaven!
The reason for Hare's outburst was clear. Ned had just stomped into view, with moonlight gleaming on the armor and sparks drifting from its chimneys. Pistols were fitted into their slots on both hands.
I will shoot no man if he gives up his arms and promises to leave the police force,
he called, the armor magnifying his voice into a resonating iron boom.
But let any policeman or other man who does not throw up his arms directly know the consequences, which is a speedy dispatch to kingdom come.
In the veranda's darkness, Ike heard the other gang members shifting into position and cocking their weapons. But he knew that if he called them out to the constables, he would immediately be shot. Heart pounding, he could do nothing more than wait. Ned and the police stood facing each other for long minutes. No one moved or spoke. And then a shot broke the night's silence, followed immediately by the bell-like tone of the ricochet off Ned's armor. In one smooth move, Ned swiveled at the waist, leveled his pistol, and fired. One of the constables fell with a shriek of pain. The night erupted into a bedlam of flashes, gunshots, and screamed. Most of the shooting came from the police, and all of that was directed at Ned, who strode rapidly toward the train as though the storm of bullets were no more than a summer shower. He fired only sparingly, but each shot brought another policeman down. Meanwhile, the gang was firing with abandon from their concealment on the veranda, but the police ignored them. Between the noise of their own guns and the obvious target of Ned's armored figure, they did not seem to recognize that they were being killed from two directions. It was a slaughter. Ike bit his lip until the iron taste of blood filled his mouth. Goliath, his wonderful creation, was performing spectacularly, but what a terrible task it performed. The armored suit strode through the chaos like a juggernaut, extracting a deadly toll from the police. A few brave officers rushed it, hoping perhaps to find some weakness, only to be smacked brutally aside by an iron fist or smashed into the earth by a piston-like leg. The remaining police fell back behind the train engine, but with mechanical persistence Ned pursued them. So did the other gang members, who slipped from the veranda and fell in behind Ned to snipe at the police from behind the impregnable wall of Goliath's bulk. It seemed that within minutes the rout of the police would be complete. And then, rising above the rattle and bang of gunfire and ricochets, Ike heard a terrific sound he'd only heard once before in his life. The high, keening whistle of a steam boiler under too much pressure. The last time he'd heard that sound had been on his great steamship's shakedown cruise. Moments later, the boiler had burst, with sufficient force to throw the number one funnel into the air. 5 stokers had died in the explosion. Ike knew Goliath's boiler design was near the limits of its materials. It had been the only way to achieve the necessary power-to-weight ratio, but now it seemed those limits were about to be exceeded. All of Ike's engineering instincts demanded he tell Ned to throw the relief valve wide open. A simple twist of one knob would release the excess pressure and prevent an explosion, preserving the equipment, the lives of those nearby, and Ike's sense of himself as an engineer. He shook himself, surged to his feet, and ran towards the battle.
"Close the relief valve, Ned!"
he cried at the limit of his lungs.
"Close the relief valve!"
In the midst of the gunfire, the clanging and hissing of the armor, and the shriek of the overloaded boiler, Ike heard a tiny squeak. The pitch of the anguished boiler's whistle rose as the pressure built. Ike's mind roiled with equations of tensile strength, steam pressure, and temperature. And then, with a Brobdingnagian thunder, the armor exploded. Fragments of metal flew in every direction. Blown backwards by the blast, Ike sprawled across the veranda steps. A series of crashes, loud enough to penetrate the ringing in his ears, followed as chunks of the armor landed all around him. Then came a blow to the head, and darkness.
"He's coming around."
The words sounded as though they were pushing their way through a half-mile of cotton batting. Ike's eyes blinked open, then immediately clenched shut against the pain of daylight. He clutched his aching head and felt bandages.
"Oh!"
was all he could manage.
"Here, sir, have some tea."
The tin cup scalded his lip. The tea was vile, bitter eucalyptus. He sipped gratefully.
"Constable Phillips, sir,"
the man introduced himself. His face showed that he was shouting at the top of his lungs, but the words were barely audible.
"I'll need to take a statement, sir."
The resulting shouted conversation would have been laughable if the matter hadn't been so serious. So many had died. More than 30 police officers, 8 of the passengers, and of course Ned himself, as well as all 3 members of his gang. Ike tried to give an honest report as best as he could manage with the ringing in his ears, and not to try to excuse his own part in the debacle. At least, in the end, he'd forced common sense to triumph over engineering instinct. For all the damage he'd caused, at least he'd managed that.
"You must have been terrified, sir!" the constable shouted. "With those bushrangers holding their guns to your head, making you build that armor, sir!"
Ike's hearing was beginning to return, but that wasn't the only reason he winced at the constable's words.
"Well, to be frank, I..."
But before Ike could explain, another policeman approached, an older and apparently superior officer, and the 2 men held a conversation that Ike couldn't hear. The second man addressed Ike.
"Senior Constable Kelly, sir, we're trying to identify the person who sent the telegram that warned us about the ambush."
"That would be me."
The senior constable's face lit up with gratitude.
"Then you are the hero of the day, sir!"
He pumped Ike's hand with painful enthusiasm, then ran off. Ike saw him conversing animatedly with a crowd of civilians pointing in his direction. They immediately came running, shoving each other.
"Well done, sir!" cried one, and "What's your name, sir?" another.
There was no point in denying the truth.
"Brunel,"
he admitted.
"Isambard Kingdom, Brunel."
The man who'd asked his name seemed nonplussed.
"Isambard Kingdom Brunel? Like the famous engineer?"
He studied Ike's face.
"Dear Lord! You are Brunel!"
"Who?" asked another man.
"The designer of Paddington Station, man! The Clifton Suspension Bridge! The Great Eastern, the greatest steamship in all history?"
Ike waved a dismissive hand.
"Greatest failure of a steamship.
Not much of a passenger liner, perhaps, but she laid the great transatlantic telegraph cable."
The man blinked.
"I'm John McWhirter from the Argus, Mr. Brunel. Where have you been all these years, sir? The public think you dead."
The press. Of course the press would be here. They'd come on the train with the constables to report the apprehension of the notorious outlaw Ned Kelly. But they had gotten far more of a story than they'd dreamed of. The dramatic siege, the unprecedented steam-powered armor, the spectacular explosion, and now the discovery of a celebrated engineer thought dead for 20 years. As they bombarded him with questions, the reporters insisted that Goliath was his crowning achievement.
"You'll make millions, sir," said the man from the Herald. "Every military on Earth will want 1,000 of them."
The idea was tempting, very tempting. To return to England, to see his son's and his wife's grave, to reap the financial rewards that had eluded him in his previous life, a very attractive notion indeed. But then I considered the consequences of such a return. To be the father of an army of those death-dealing machines? Just one had caused more carnage and destruction in a single hour than Ike had witnessed in the rest of his entire long life. And yet, now that the principle had been demonstrated, the genie was out of the bottle. He couldn't just go back into hiding. Though patents were anathema to his engineering sensibilities, common sense told him there was only one thing to do.
"No, gentlemen,"
he said, shaking his head.
"I will return to England, but only to patent Goliath and all the innovations that made it possible, licensing them for peaceful purposes only. I will do all I can in whatever years remain to me to prevent any such machine from ever being used to harm human beings again."
The reporters clamored questions.
"But surely," one of them shouted, "not even the great Brunel can prevent progress in the machines of war."
Ike held up his hand for silence.
"The way will not be easy, I admit. But today I have learned that the Great Eastern recovered from the disaster she suffered on her shakedown cruise and went on to serve mankind in another capacity."
He drew himself up to his full 5'4".
"If a steamship can reform herself and change the world, and so perhaps can her builder."
It's great to know that there's second chances in our lives. And it just goes to show you that to be a hero, you don't need to display great acts of strength, but just to subtly and cleverly do the right thing. Now, before I get too carried away this time, let's go over the cast of characters for this story. First up, we had David D. Levine, the author himself, as the narrator for this story. After hearing him read this live, I just couldn't think of anybody else better to narrate this story for us. We had Paul McLean as Ned Kelly, and I'm probably going to get this name wrong, but Marlon Dance Hoy as Ike, a.k.a. Isambard Kingdom Brunel, and a variety of other characters for the story. And again, I'm very thankful for Tim for pulling this together and getting Paul and Marlon to voice these characters. I really wanted it to have an authentic feeling to it. And I'm also grateful to Graham Dunlop for pointing me in Tim's direction. Now, I've never really done an author's note segment on this podcast, and I guess part of that's because I don't want to steal any more from the Dune Steve. But I also like the story to speak for itself. But in this case, I was impressed with the research and the history that David had put into this. And so I did ask him to write me an author's note. And I guess maybe instead of an author's note, I can call it a story spotlight. Or we could think of it as a fireside chat after the journey is complete. That we're gathering around the campfire to reminisce and to talk about our journey here today. So I'm going to read this in David's own words, so hopefully you won't get confused and think that I wrote this story. So, in David's words, the story was written for John Joseph Adams' anthology, Armored, a collection of stories about powered armor. Most of the writers submitting to it, I knew, would be working in the Starship Troopers mode of hard science fiction or space opera. But when I write for a themed anthology, I like to find a topic that's within the theme, but a little off to one side. Now, as it happens, when I traveled to Australia for the World Science Fiction Convention, I learned about the famous bushranger and outlaw Ned Kelly, whose gang's last stand involved suits of homemade armor, which I saw on display at the State Library of Victoria in Melbourne. And a steampunk version of this incident seemed unnatural for this anthology. After mulling the idea for a while, and deciding that I wanted the viewpoint character to be the engineer who builds the armor for Kelly, I realized that he could be another of my favorite historical characters, Isambard Kingdom Burnell, one of history's greatest engineers. I've been a fan of Burnell's ever since I saw the 1975 Oscar-winning short film Great, an offbeat animated musical. Unfortunately, in real life, Burnell died long before Kelly's last stand. But for purposes of the story, I decided that he had actually faked his death and gone into hiding in Australia, feeling himself a failure. The historical fact is that, despite his many triumphs, he did fail and fail and fail again, sometimes quite spectacularly. An important lesson in the value of persistence. For more information on Ned Kelly, you can see Wikipedia and glenrowan1880.com. And for more information on Isambard Kingdom Burnell, see Wikipedia and ikburnell.org.uk. And again, I will be putting these links in the show notes for you. It's interesting, you know, genre is always an interesting subject, but I guess when I heard and read this story and listened to it, I always thought of it as alternate history rather than steampunk. But really, both descriptions would apply to this story. And I really did enjoy the history behind this story, as well as the action in the story itself and the characters. And I guess I couldn't help but correlate this also with contemporary pop culture, with the success of the Iron Man and Avengers movies, in kind of thinking as Ned Kelly as a villainous steampunk version of Iron Man. That doesn't really go with what David was going for, I think, but it's kind of neat to see that correlation as well. So I'm again very thankful for David for letting me podcast this story. I'm grateful for Tim for producing it for me, and kind of excited about simultaneously airing these on both podcasts and kind of doing a cross promotion or whatever. But I really do encourage you to check out the Drama Pod. He has many different shows on there. Some of them are reminiscent of The Twilight Zone or things like that. Most of it is audio drama, which is a lot more work. You know, full cast is a lot of work, but full-on audio drama is even more work. And so it's fun to listen to that. And again, he did a tremendous job on this story. So grateful for all involved. Now, if you'd like to talk about this story, please go over to the forums at journeyinto.freeforums.org and tell us what you think. I also encourage you to go to the website at journeyintopodcast.blogspot.com and make a donation to the podcast. I'd really appreciate it, and it would really help fund many of the things that I'd like to do, to purchase many stories from authors and pay them more what they're worth, rather than the token payment that I'm able to pay at this time. I would really like to give the authors like David the respect that they deserve and pay them properly for their work. I'm so grateful for all the authors that have let me podcast their work. That's all I have to say about that. I would also like to wish everybody in the United States a happy Thanksgiving. I'm going to be able to share it with my family this year, and looking forward to doing that this week. But I'm going to leave you now, so take care while I'm gone, and I'll be back next week. Safe travels, and journey on. Let's see if I can do this super, super fast. The Journey Into podcast is produced under Creative Commons Attribution, no commercial, no derivatives license. You can share it, but don't sell it or change it. The theme music for this podcast has been provided by Man in Space.